Did you go straight to practicing law, or what did you do after that?
Yeah, I went to a medium-sized firm in the D.C. area. The firm actually had its principal office in Baltimore, and I really liked the firm. I kind of liked the culture that they had. You know, good lawyers. You know, well respected, but you know, people seemed to have lives, even though you know you had the billable hour thing going on, and so I signed on with them after doing the summer associate deal. And said, all right, I'm going to go to the Baltimore office, even though my preference was actually to go to their Northern Virginia office in Tysons Corner, Virginia. As I'm studying for the bar, they reach out and say, hey, the Maryland bar, mind you, hey, a position opened up in Virginia. Yeah. Do you want to take that position? And I was like, I do, but I'm studying for Maryland right now. So they were gracious.
Welcome to the Founding Partner Podcast. Join your host, Jonathan Hawkins, as we explore the fascinating stories of successful law firm founders. We'll uncover their beginnings, triumph over challenges, and practice growth. Whether you aspire to launch your own firm, have an entrepreneurial spirit, or are just curious about the legal business, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
All right, welcome to Founding Partner Podcast. I'm Jonathan Hawkins, your host. We're going to have some fun today. We've got a really cool guest with a cool background. We've got Christian Simpson with us today. He's a personal injury lawyer out of, I believe, Virginia, D.C. area. And we'll dive into this, but he used to be a professional basketball player, so we're going to talk all about that. So, Christian, why don't you introduce yourself, tell us about where you are, your firm, what areas you serve, and all that.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, Jonathan. It's really good to be on your show, and I've listened to some of your shows already, so I know that you go deep with your guests. But my deal is that I started Virginia Injury Law back in 2015, and since that time, we've grown to 5 lawyers, a good number of staff over 3 locations in Virginia. We're in Richmond, we're in Norfolk and Virginia Beach, and then I'm actually resident in Alexandria. So I've been lucky enough to find, good people that can manage those offices for me while I'm, largely remote. So I obviously go down to those places from time to time and make sure that, I have a presence. But by and large, I work out of my home. And go to see clients as needed or go to see the team members as needed.
Okay, we're going to dig into all of that stuff. I'm really interested in how you manage the remote offices. I think that's a challenge. And so I want to hear how you do it. But before we get into all that, as I mentioned, you played basketball in college and then you were able to play professionally as well. So tell us about your basketball career. I want to hear more about that. That's cool.
Yeah. I'm a hoop guy, man. A hoop fanatic still. The bouncing ball is always attracting me. And I got recruited out of high school here in the D.C. area in Alexandria, Virginia. And, neat story there is that the coach that recruited me, his niece was like best friends and teammates with one of my sisters. So they go up to basketball camp at Bucknell University, have a blast, sleepaway camp. They come back and, oh, so much fun. And they're like, hey, maybe we should let the little guy go, next summer. Like, he's all into this basketball thing. So I go up to the camp, have a great week, just had so much fun. And my older brother comes to pick me up at the end of it. And the head coach, a guy named Charlie Woolham, comes out and he goes, he had a great week. And he's a really good player. If he keeps working at it, maybe one day he'll play in college. And sure as shooting, that same coach is in my living room years later. He pulls out the camp photo, right, of nice. Me as a little guy with my socks up to my knees and everything. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. So I go to Bucknell. I was able to crack the starting lineup as a sophomore. The program was really in a good place already. They'd gone to the tournament in both 1987 and 89. And it just joined the Patriot League, which people probably know of now, but back then that thing was literally brand new. Like, I was in the first year of the Patriot League. We had great teams there that couldn't get into the tournament, right? Because it's a one bid league. Like, you got to win that conference tournament at the end, no matter how good your regular season is. And my sophomore and junior years, we were either the outright or co-champions of the conference in the regular season and lost in the final game to get to the NCAA tournament. Oh, so a little bitter taste there for me, but I had, you know, I had a great career there, was fortunate to, you know, be inducted in the Hall of Fame there a number of years ago. And I went off to Europe after playing at Bucknell and played just a single year in Holland. I had a chance to do more, but I was a little too serious. I think now looking back, I'm like, man, I should have played at least another like 2 or 3 years before I jumped into being a professional. But at the time I'm like, let me go back and, you know, sort of get back to, you know, the ultimate goal. I kind of knew I wanted to go to law school, you know, coming out of college, but yeah, in hindsight, I should have just bounced that ball for as long as they let me and paid me.
So what's it like? What's the European league like? I mean, how does it compare? I mean, to US, is it pretty big over there? And, you know, are you traveling all over Europe? Where all are you going?
Yeah. So, I mean, you play in your individual country that you're at, right? There's like top division, but there's multiple divisions in each country. I was in the top division in Holland. Holland isn't known as having, you know, one of the, you know, like most prestigious leagues or whatever, but they had some really good players there. There's only, they allow a couple of foreigners on each team, right? And the assumption for many years was like, okay, you bring in like two Americans and they score all the points for you and kind of carry you across the finish line. But in truth, the Americans, and sometimes there'd be players from other countries, like Serbia had really good players, which is no surprise now. We see Nikola Jokic, right, as the best player in the world. But players from that country usually were the ones who determined whether or not you're going to win. Because, you know, the Americans, we just kind of canceled each other out, right? Like, I get 20, you get 20, you know, the other guy gets 20. Like, and so, but if my Dutch guys are better than your Dutch guys, we're going to win.
That makes sense.
And if you're, to your question about traveling around, you have to really be in the top tier of the league. So if you're one of the like top two or three teams in the top division, then you get to play EuroLeague. And that's like, that's some serious basketball being played there, right? You've got the top teams from each country. They play during the week. Like you have your games for the country that you're in on the weekend. But if you're in EuroLeague, you actually play during the week and you'll travel around and play these top teams. We never got there. The team that I was on, brand new coach. I was a young guy. There's a guy from Georgia who I played with, a guy named, well, his nickname was Big Mo. But you know, we struggled most of the year and then played well at the end. So we never really had a shot to, you know, to travel around. We just kind of see all the, you know, all the top level teams talk about what they were doing, playing in Spain or Germany or wherever.
So if you got to travel around, maybe you would have stuck around a little longer, or maybe
not.
I
was there for the experience. I mean, in all honesty, I thought to myself, and I got offered by my club to play one more year in the same place. And I was like, I'm really trying to like see Europe kind of thing. So, you know, I don't really want to stay in the same place. And so what ended up happening is when I came back to the U.S. that summer after our season was over, I had an agent, so he's looking around, and missed out on a job in Sweden. Would have loved to go there and spend a year, you know, sort of checking out that country. And then I took a job at my old school at Bucknell in the admissions office. And literally like 2 days later, the agent calls up and he says, I got a job in Ireland. You know, you can go play there. It's a great country. And, you know, you can, you know, keep playing, right? Knew two guys who had played in Ireland. One of them I had played against in Holland that year. And they're like, hey, look, if you go there, you're going to have a lot of fun. Like, they party. they're going to be like, but if you're trying to, like, have a basketball career over here in Europe, that's not maybe they're like, you're going to score 40 points a game. You're going to, you know, all that stuff. They're going to, you know, they love to drink, you know, you're going to have a great time, but that's kind of what it is. So the offer came in and I could have taken it. You know, I could have said, all right, you know what, let me postpone the real world for a little bit longer. But for some unknown reason, I said no.
Well, you know, you're serious. You wanted to get started. You said you knew you want to be a lawyer. We'll get into that. But did you go straight into law, or did you do something before law school, or
yeah,
before mixing law?
Yeah, I ended up taking a job in the admissions office at Bucknell. So I did that for a year, applied to law school, got accepted to William & Mary, which is where I, you know, eventually ended up going. But I actually deferred the acceptance and worked a second year at Bucknell in that admissions office. I had a different position there as essentially a students of color, a diversity recruiter. And so that was interesting to me to be in that role. And so I just, you know, deferred law school for a year.
Okay. So then you graduate law school. Did you go straight to practicing law, or what did you do after that?
Yeah, I went to a medium-sized firm in the D.C. area. The firm actually had its principal office in Baltimore, and I really liked the firm. I kind of liked the culture that they had. You know, good lawyers. You know, well respected, but you know, people seemed to have lives, even though you know you had the billable hour thing going on, and so I signed on with them after doing the summer associate deal. And said, all right, I'm going to go to the Baltimore office, even though my preference was actually to go to their Northern Virginia office in Tysons Corner, Virginia. As I'm studying for the bar, they reach out and say, hey, the Maryland bar, mind you, hey, a position opened up in Virginia. Yeah. Do you want to take that position? And I was like, I do, but I'm studying for Maryland right now. So they were gracious. They said, go ahead, finish studying for Maryland. You know, knock that out of the park, and we'll let you, you know, study for Virginia and get that under your belt once you're with us. So that's what I end up doing.
So you went to insurance defense. So let's get into this. You said you knew you wanted to be a lawyer. Now are you a third generation or more generation lawyer?
It's third generation. You know, my grandfather was a lawyer, and my father as well was a lawyer. Before that, you know, I had, you know, family members that were in varying degrees of public service. And so, you know, even with, you know, with just the two lawyers in front of me, which I think is, you know, probably enough by most people's estimation, there was definitely like a, you know, a real strong lineage there of, you know, public service. And that, you know, bore out because my grandfather was, you know, a lawyer, but he was, you know, the vice president of Liberia, which is the country that I was born in, and didn't move here to the U.S. until I was 5 years old, or just shy of five.
Yeah. So what was that like, having your grandfather be the vice president of a country? Tell me about that. I assume, you know, you came over here when you were five, but I assume you still visited, maybe you still visit today. And yeah, did you get sort of special treatment, or was it
well,
some cool stuff?
It's a small country. My grandfather passed away before I did, but my dad, you know, was also, you know, he held very high positions. So my dad was the Minister of Justice for a period of time, which is essentially the Attorney General there. But he also was like the youngest Supreme Court justice in the history of the country, right? So our family name, which is a big deal in Liberia, is just very well known. I mean, it's to the point, to give you just a sense, like we went back this past summer. I took my family. I like to, you know, give them a chance to kind of see where we're from, where they're from. I took my family in the summer, and I went to a grocery store to, you know, to get some stuff. We were just kind of hanging out at my brother's house, and this woman at the cash register looks at me and she says, "Do you have Simpson blood?" You know, I mean, and I was like, "Wow," you know, I mean, I hadn't been back to this place in like 6 years, right? But she just took one look at me, looked me up and down, and you know, and had me figured out. So
they got money. They got money with your picture on there, right?
That's right, right, right. So it's a thing. I mean, it's definitely a thing. I had a teacher in high school who went to Liberia. He was African as well, but he goes to Liberia for a trip, educational trip. And he, you know, knew my family's origin there, but he came back and he's like, "Oh my God," he said, "I told people that I was teaching the Simpson kids and it was a whole different response."
That's awesome. Yeah, so it sounds like you were born to be a lawyer. I mean, it's in your blood. It's almost inevitable. Did your dad or your family sort of not necessarily pressure you, but sort of say, this is what you're going to do? Or did you feel pressure to do that?
No, I didn't feel pressure to do it, which is, it's a good question for me because my older brother is, Clarence Simpson the third, right? So by all rights, he was supposed to, jump in there and be a lawyer. And he found himself, dealing with that pressure of, oh man, this is what I'm supposed to do. So super smart guy. He graduates high school early, he's like 16, and goes to college. Does, incredibly well. And my dad had gone to Georgetown Law School. So that's where my brother goes. He ends up going to Georgetown Law. He's like one of the youngest kids there. And he was done in a year and a half. And not like his grades were bad or anything. Like, he's just like, what am I doing here? Like, why am I in this place? And so for him, that pressure was there. He felt it. And it wasn't his path. That wasn't what he was supposed to be doing. Me, by contrast, I go to college at Bucknell, and we got into a little bit of a situation when I was a freshman. And unfortunately, some buddies of mine on the basketball team weren't behaving too well, and we find ourselves in front of a magistrate judge on some alcohol charges, right? So the coach wanted to keep things really quiet, and so there's a local lawyer that was really, big supporter of the team. And he goes, all right, you three guys go talk to this lawyer. He'll sort of tell you what to do. And so we show up at his office. We didn't know what was about to happen to us. And he starts telling us what we need to do to challenge the charge. And then at the end of it, he goes, all right, well, one of you guys, we're going to bifurcate this. Like, you'll go separate to these two and all this stuff. And he said, but someone's going to have to talk. And who's that going to be? And my friends just look at me and go, it's going to be him. So, at that point, I think I started to get the sense that, all right, this is where I'm headed. I had fun with the police officer on the stand. At one point, he said that he had made an assumption about the alcohol, and I shut him down. I'm 18 years old, and I say, listen, sir, we don't need you making any assumptions. What do you know? Please tell us what you know. And the
Oh, yeah.
magistrate judge has got his head like bared. He's laughing, like, in this courtroom, this 18-year-old kid is dressing down a cop. So yeah, I was kind of headed there or headed
Yeah,
here.
it was your calling. You got it. So, all right. Well, cool. Let's get back to sort of the law firm. So, you ended up at an insurance defense firm for some period of time. How long did you stay there? And obviously, you left at some point to start a firm.
Yeah, I was there for 6 years, and I started out doing medical malpractice defense, but eventually slid over into the employment law field and had equal time in both spaces. So, good experience, really good lawyers that I was able to learn from, some good mentors there. But I actually left the practice to try to be a sports agent. Had restarted the Sports and Entertainment Law Society at William & Mary with a buddy, and thought, this seems more like what I should be doing. Just there's an entrepreneurial component to it, and so I tried to be a sports agent, getting players overseas to play basketball. And then I also had a connection, a Liberian kid who was playing at Georgia Tech, whose family we were close to, and they knew my history. And I thought, okay, there's a chance for me to nab a kid and be a sports agent. But I had a lot of fun, Jonathan, but I didn't make a lot of money, right? I had a lot of fun. So you're down there, in Atlanta, and you'll enjoy this story. So the kids at Georgia Tech,
That's my
I
school,
follow
right?
him.
That's where I went undergrad.
Yeah. I follow him for 3 years, right? Going to football games all across the country. I'm in LA. I'm doing all this stuff. And the dad is like, hey, you're our guy. Mom is on board. Your family, same country, all this stuff, right? And he said, we've told him our preferences on and on. So I'm feeling really good about it. And then I get a call from the dad. Hey, we've made every decision for him up to this point. And we told him where to go to college. We told, all this stuff. He said, but he's a man now. We're going to let him make his own decision. Well, unbeknownst to me, and I should have known it, right? That's why it wasn't my business full time. He had a buddy who was also from the Atlanta area and had, gone to school with him for 3 years. And that buddy was going to be the number two pick in the draft. He went about 6 foot 5 inches tall, played wide receiver, and had the nickname Megatron. Oh, yeah. Calvin Johnson was getting recruited by all the top sports agents in the country to sign with them. And my guy was like a third day guy, but they're like, he's Calvin's buddy. So he was getting recruited with Calvin Johnson. So I had no friggin' shot of signing this kid.
And, you know, that's a funny story. So I have a similar story. I'm not going to name names, but so where I grew up, this was years ago, football player. He was projected to be number one, he's quarterback, number one draft pick. And there were a couple lawyers in town that were friends with his family, and his family was like, you're the guy. So they went and got their NFL agent, license, whatever it was, and they were doing everything. And then one day, his uncle showed up in a new car with some gold chains on, and they said they knew. So yeah, he went elsewhere too, and it was, I think, one of his buddies on his team was going with some other person. So that's where.
Yeah, it's a nasty business, the agent business. I mean, to be blunt about it, and so, you know, once that dream sort of died on the vine, I started looking to where I was going to go next. I end up getting an opportunity with a plaintiff's firm, because the big firms at this point, they're scared about, you know, bringing me on. They're like, hold on a second, you left once, you'll leave again. And so this little boutique firm that did key TAM work took me in, and I started, you know, doing key TAM cases in the DC area. The firm was over leveraged, right? And had tremendous success early, and then got, you know, ahead of themselves. And so I found myself a couple years in with them. And, you know, they're, like I said, all of a sudden bills aren't getting paid. You know, you're seeing all these things happening, and, you know, new family, just had a daughter born, et cetera. And sure enough, they say, hey, you know, we got to let you go, right? This isn't working out for us. So the genesis of me starting my own firm, it happened then, even though I had more journey to go. Talked to a friend, a lawyer who's solo, and he said, you know, I feel your pain on this, but you need to figure out how to get out on your own and control your own destiny. So I always remembered those words from him, even though I still had another detour. I worked for the federal government for, you know, 4 years after that through some contacts. I was doing really consulting work, but then opening the firm began with me starting to do some personal injury work on the side of that, and seeing that was a space that I could potentially operate.
And so, I guess that was in 2015, you eventually said, all right, you're going full time. What led you to say, all right, it's time, I'm going out?
Yeah, I mean, I'd always had an entrepreneurial bent. I mean, even in law school, I started a women's college basketball summer league that, you know, ended up having legs. You know, Carol Lawson, the coach at Duke now, the women's coach at Duke, she played in my league. I mean, you know, so I always had this sort of, hey, I can go whip something together and make it work sort of mentality. And so we're there, or I'm there in the Baltimore area at the time. And the guy that I'm working with says, you know, there's a firm down here that's doing, you know, 30 or 40 cases at this one clinic each month. And that's a lot of cases for, you know, for one clinic from one firm. And I said, what's the guy's name? And he told me the name. I said, oh yeah, he's an advertiser. The guy, he advertises here and he advertises down in Atlanta, because I was down there for work and I heard the same advertisement. So he's like, oh wow, that's crazy. Let me, you know, or let's get a hold of this guy, kind of see what the deal is. So we talked to the guy who was licensing his brand to these different law firms, and he starts throwing out some crazy numbers, and I think it sounds pretty good. We hang up the phone and my buddy goes, man, he's full of shit. He wasn't buying it. So I said, well, look, I got to go back down to Atlanta. I have work down there. So I'll reach out to the guy in Atlanta who's using the licensing campaign and just, you know, do due diligence on it. And that's what started it. I ended up figuring out that, okay, this is something that does work and I want to try it. But the fun part of my story, and I wouldn't recommend this to anybody, is that I did it the old-fashioned way with credit cards and loans. So I'm sitting in my basement. I had a business plan. My wife was like, you better have a business plan. You better have all these people look at it. I had a buddy who did come up with some money. He was a venture capital guy. He had $30,000 laying around, but my business plan said I needed $300,000 to start, right? And I already knew I wasn't getting that money. I was hoping to get half and just roll the dice. So I start looking at stuff online, and sure enough, I'm on like LendingTree, I think it is, and they say personal loans for business. So I start filling it out, and next thing you know, boom, you're approved for like $30,000. Oh, wow. That was easy. But then I realized that $30,000 that they're going to give me is going to show up on other applications if I go to these other companies to do the same thing. And so you know what happened after that. I just went from company to company that same night, four times, maybe five, and got a lot of money really quickly and said, let's go.
Nice. Real quick, thanks for listening. If you're getting any value out of this podcast, please take 2 seconds to hit the subscribe button and leave a 5-star review. It would really mean a lot to me. Now back to the show. Yeah, that was going to be my question. Did you have a nest egg? But obviously, no. Okay, so you take out all these loans. What, you know, yeah. Obviously you believed in yourself, and it sounds like your wife was behind you. I'm not sure she knew what you did that night, but
she didn't know that was a source of concern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because that's, you know, a big, you know, most lawyers are risk averse. I mean, that's just by nature. I guess it's beat into us. I don't know. So, you know, obviously it's worked out. But yeah, most people would not have done that. So you believed in yourself. You said, all right, we're going to go. So you took out the loans and you started going. And we all know with PI cases, you know, best case.
It takes time.
Yeah, best case, maybe 6 months, but probably more like 18 at least months for that really to start moving. So how did you make it work until they started paying out?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was fortunate. We were able to get a little bit of a cushion, you know, with some of the things that I had available before that, but not at a level that, you know, could have supported us long term over time. So what I did was I just hung on, honestly, for those first, you know, I'd say 18 to 24 months. Just hung on for dear life. And you know, I still remember my wife asking, like, well, you know, I know what plan A is. What's plan B? Like, if this doesn't work, I said, well, plan B is plan A, right? Like, we've got to make this thing work. So I ultimately, you know, I was in that debt game. I borrowed more, right? So I'd borrow against cases. If I had good cases, I'd borrow against those. I think the people that I borrowed from, some of whom were attorneys, were shocked that I was paying them back quickly. I think they were used to seeing the lawyers who were doing what I was doing, you know, maybe not be able to meet those obligations. But what the lever was for me to get out of that situation, so we started 2015 late, 2016, I'm accumulating cases at a good rate, by the way. Like, I've got plenty of inventory, which is a tremendous blessing at the time. And so late 2016, I brought in somebody who had run a PI firm before and knew what the hell he was doing. And so late 2016, we said, all right, we're going to switch how we manage these cases and do it through the Needles platform at the time. So he knew it. And I knew that would help us overall, help my team overall in terms of moving cases more efficiently through our pipeline. And so 2017, the beginning was super rough. Clients were not happy. We were just, you know, telling them, hey, bear with us. We're growing pains, et cetera, et cetera. And then right around the spring, you know, right around this time, actually, of the year, it started to shift. And the foundation that had been laid started to turn into real traction, and we started to get it done. And I did travel that summer to Liberia. My younger brother was getting married. My wife and I finally had a chance to, like, because I'd just been hustling for these, you know, 2 years or whatever. She barely saw me. We finally had a chance to spend some time together. I came clean about the loans, and she wasn't happy about that. But I also told her, I was like, hey, like, it's working. You know, our trajectory is such that were there and I could see it. And before, I was just kind of one foot in front of the other. I didn't have a big picture view to really be able to be confident in that, but now I had it. And so that's what happened. We finished the year strong. I literally paid off. I started off, I borrowed about $130,000. Over time, I borrowed in total about $250,000 just to kind of keep it afloat. I had that all paid off in 2017 by September. And so at that point, you know, where all systems go, 2018 was a great year. But then I then the troubles happened because I said, oh my God, I know what I'm doing now, and I'm going to grow this thing and just, you know, blow up into the stratosphere. I made the mistake of going to John Morgan's conference down in Orlando, and I thought I had this great year, made all this money, and then I heard what these guys were doing. I'm like, all right, I think I need to recalibrate.
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple things you said. Number one, you know, I think it's hard to get your footing, but, you know, once, you know, you have the foundation, then you can launch off of that. So obviously it took you a while, but you got it. But then the second part is, you know, there are always levels, and leveling up, there's more trouble ahead. You know, you figure out one level, and then when you go to the next, you know, it's a whole new ball game. So it sounds like you got to that point.
I did. Yeah. So I came back just, you know, tons of piss and vinegar from that conference. Like, oh man, I'm ready. We're going to go on TV. We're going to do this. We're going to, you know, all this stuff. And I read exactly one book on scaling, Vern Harnish's book that, you know, I'm sure most of your listeners are very familiar with. And it's sitting right next to me here still. Read that one book and said, all right, I'm good. You know, let's get it going. and then did so many things wrong at the same time that I knew better than to do, right? Because I'd been a consultant, you know, even though it was with the government, talking to people about change management and how you plan, you build, and you know, all these things I had been doing. But then with my own business and my own firm, I'm so gung-ho that I just dive in, and we start making all these large scale changes at the same time, opening offices, changing. Even though we were in the same building in Richmond, we moved to, you know, to a bigger, you know, we moved and took over a floor and, you know, all these things, and then opened another office down in Norfolk, and we're hiring. I mean, there's just, we changed our case management system. I mean, I can go on and on. I mean, I cataloged it later as sort of a, you know, remember when you did this moment, but, you know,
It sounds a little familiar. I thought.
So, you know, you get excited about stuff and then you forget, like, you know, my employees, they were just dying. They were dying. And there were good people who we just had our best year ever. And so they believed in me. Right. I mean, they were like, hey, Christian knows what he's doing. I mean, my check and that bonus that came at Christmas, I've never seen anything like that, you know? So they were like, you know, whatever this guy says, we're going to try to do. So that was a really humbling time, because all those changes, the additional money being spent, et cetera, they led to problems, you know, particularly on the case management side. That's where it started to show up first. We started getting, you know, more bar complaints, more stuff coming down the line. And that, you know, that was, you know, that was just taxing. I mean, my, you know, home life wasn't happy. I wasn't happy at work. I mean, you know, none of the things that I expected when I said, oh, I'm going to scale and, you know, go into the stratosphere, none of those things was happening for me at that time.
So you went through the tough times, we'll call it the leveling up times, but sounds like you sort of eventually reached an equilibrium, or you sort of figured it out, and you've got, I think you said three locations that you're managing. It sounds like that's, you've got that sort of figured out at least. And the other thing I want to hear about that, how you figured that out. But then also the other thing I want to have you touch on is the culture of your firm. I know that's important to you from some of our prior conversations. I like your attitude about it, and maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, the coming out of it was just a process of literally taking a step back and doing a deep dive on what we were doing, how we were doing it, why we're doing it. and then frankly, starting to listen to other people who had been there. I hired a business coach, good on a number of fronts, but mindset was huge there, because I kind of lost my swagger after, you know, getting punched in the mouth. We had someone come in and assess the firm and say, all right, what do you want to do? Okay. All right. This is where we see you guys, where we see you being strong, where, you know, you need work. And then I was fortunate to come across the Cameron Harrell book, Vivid Vision. And my coach and I both agreed, perfect timing, take 2 or 3 days, figure out what you want to do and why you're doing this. You know, really take stock and figure out where you want to be. Best 2.5 days I've spent, right? Just getting away, no calls, no nut, and just going, all right, pen and a paper. And I just went to town for those 2 days, really hashing out where I wanted us to go and what I wanted us to be. And part of that was the core values piece. Ours are integrity, consistency, and empathy. I was very clear in that document, and I just had some conversations with some new employees today that I wanted people who were serious about what they do, but didn't take themselves too seriously. I mean, you've heard me laugh a ton already, you know, in this podcast, and it's because I am super serious about what we do, and I get after it. You know, that athletic background is, you know, it just never leaves, right? I'm competitive. But that team sports aspect of it for me is that I like to see people do well. I like to see my people, you know, do well. And it excites me. It gets me pumped up to see people grow and get better. And so I want that energy in the firm. I want other people who are similarly situated in terms of that mindset and can laugh as we're grinding it out and but are still obviously, you know, very serious about the work that they do.
You know, I was going to ask you about that, sort of the parallels and the lessons learned from all the years of playing basketball, all the hard work in the team sport to get, you know, to be able to play at a professional level. How does that, or what lessons or what, you know, what does that bring to you as a leader in building your firm?
I had some amazing mentors. My high school basketball coach was the very first one. And even today, I sort of marvel at this guy because he was literally in his early 20s when he started coaching me and others. But he seemed to have it all figured out in terms of really living by your values, you know, just having that be foundational. And then, you know, a mindset of, you know, no shortcuts. I mean, this guy, you know, just sort of laid it out for us, like, this is what you need to do to be great. This is what you need to do to be a good teammate. And we're shooting for, you know, everything that's out there for us, right? But he never talked about winning, even though we won a crazy amount. He always talked about the process that got you there, right? And leaning into that. And we're in the middle of a process right now, my team and I, as we are in the third year of the Vivid Vision, where we've got some massive goals ahead of us. And this coach of mine unfortunately passed away last September, but I have literally been preaching his gospel to my team about leaning into the things that I want us focused on in order to meet these massive goals that we've laid out. So, you know, the competitiveness and all of that is there. But he was about doing it the right way and being classy about it and then just recognizing people. You know, he didn't take a lot of credit, even though, you know, all of his former players, he left the area that I grew up in and that he coached me in, and he coached in Pittsburgh was athletic director, and he won a ton of games up there too. You know what I mean? It's like in all different sports, you know, just a quintessential teacher and motivator. And so that's what I'm hoping to bring to my team now, because I'm not as involved in the day-to-day casework. You know, I'm trying to set people up to succeed as opposed to, you know, all these cases that are coming in, I'm the one managing them.
You know, I like the team aspect and the mindset, and it's sort of, you know, to go back what you said earlier, when you're in Europe, in Holland, you know, it was all about the Holland teammates as to whether you were going to win or not, right? So, I mean, It's really, you know, the weakest link. It's you're as strong as the weakest link. And, you know, I think that's pretty cool that you have that background that you can bring to this. And, it, you know, it sounds like you guys won a lot. But, you know, the other thing is when you lose, you got to go back out there the next day. You got to shake it off and you got to keep going, right?
Yeah, no doubt. And look, I like to joke around. I'm, you know, definitely someone who enjoys life, and that's probably coming across. But, you know, I get up early in the morning because I'm an early riser just by nature. My father was as well, and I definitely saw it from him. But I love grinding. Like, it's, you know, got to be something I want to do. And this is something that, I really enjoy doing. But you know, 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m., my wife, the people that work for it, they think I'm crazy, right? But I love it. You know, I absolutely, you know, wake up each morning. I don't even drink coffee. I mean, I'm caffeinated on my own, right? Ready to go. And what motivates me now, you know, we're in a position where, you know, I certainly make enough money. I damn sure make more money than when I was with the federal government. You know, I make enough money that, you know, we're comfortable and everything's good. And yet what motivates me now isn't, oh, I'm going to make more. It's no, like, we're building something that's really cool. And I have a chance to impact these people that are working for me, these people that are trusting me with their cases. You know, that is what gets me, you know, just jacked in the morning. I just love it. Had a client today that I spoke with. She's had like two cases with us, and we've referred her out for a couple of poor things. She's like pretty fragile, but, you know, she just really paid me a high compliment in terms of our relationship. And I told her, I was like, you know, this is the stuff that gets me psyched for my day. Like I said, I appreciate you sharing that. And I was like, it's going to carry me for not just today, but a bunch of days, but that's what gets me really excited.
That's cool. And you need it. I mean, if it's just about the money, I don't think you can live off that. It's like, you'd be running on fumes at some point. You know, you got to have something bigger. So I want to get into your vision, and I know you've got a good one. I want to get into that in a second, but before we get into that, sort of, you know, let's talk about, you know, some of the good parts and the bad parts of just running your firm and owning your firm. So, you know, if you could pick, you know, one of the worst things or the things that perhaps frustrate you the most about being the boss and having to run the firm. And then on the flip side, what do you think's sort of the best thing?
Yeah, I think that the toughest thing is simply, you know, I want to forge, I'm a believer in forging good relationships with, you know, with the people on my team. I think, again, the basketball sports thing, you know, Krzyzewski, you know, that whole Olympic experience for him where he said, you know, I spent most of my time just talking to these guys and getting to know them, right? So I think that's hugely important. And yet when you form those relationships, you know, not every one of them is going to work out, right? And so I've been in that position on a number of occasions where, you know, someone has really helped me and my team. And yet now we're at a point where, you know, their skill set and whatever is going on with us is no longer a match. It's no longer a fit. I know a lot of people that do EOS encounter this as they are building out leadership teams and seeing, do we have the right people in the, you know, in the right seats? And that happened to us. And we're just a recent adopter of EOS, but the same sort of thing happened even, you know, before that. And that's a hard thing, you know, because, you know, is a good person. They've helped you, right? They've helped you get to where you are, but it's not, it's, you know, my responsibilities to the business and to the clients. And that's not a relationship that can continue.
Yeah. Yeah. That's rough. So what's the best part? What's your favorite part about running the firm?
I like the vision stuff. You know, I like the dreaming. I mean, I think back to when I was a kid playing baseball, and, you know, baseball ended up being too slow for me. I was pretty decent at the game, but I was like, I need more action going on. And I'd be sitting out there. I was in the outfield, not because I wasn't any good, but because they figured I could run to all the balls that were hit to the other kids who couldn't get to them. But I would just sit out there and be playing out scenarios in my head about, oh, if this happened and that. And I have a lot of fun, you know, thinking about, you know, the things that I can do with what, you know, I've been able to create with others over the course of the last eight plus years. And that's a lot of fun for me. I love learning, listening to podcasts and listening and reading books and just learning from people. I am a big believer in talking to other law firm owners and learning how they did it. I've gotten a tremendous amount of value out of that. And so, yeah, when I'm in that space of kind of figuring out the path and thinking about some things, you know, two, three steps ahead, that's really fun.
You know, it's, people talk about business is one of the infinite games. It never ends. And you can, you know, sort of the whole point of it is to keep playing. And so, you know,
yeah, just stay in it.
Yep, and you've done that. That's cool. I really like, you know, I like what you're saying about the vision. And I like Vivid Vision. That's a really cool book. He's got some good talks out there where he's talking about the Vivid Vision. I like the one where he's got that the music festival and the one guy's dancing and everybody goes to it. Yeah, so let's talk about your vision for your firm. Whatever you're willing to share, you know, you've got three offices, sky's the limit. What's the big time vision for you?
Yeah, we, again, have really leaned into, we, meaning me in particular, but I've really leaned into getting good counsel from other good lawyers and law firms across the country. And I probably will talk to maybe one attorney a month or so. And sometimes it's great to get confirmation that we're doing things, you know, the right way. And other times it's just a little thing, tweak here or there. But I always come away with a tremendous amount of value, and I'm super appreciative of those lawyers for sharing, you know, how they've done it, basically. For us right now, we're on the cusp of getting to an eight-figure, you know, being an eight-figure firm. And so that's the next step for us. And a big part of that is really just leaning into focus on the story of our clients and how that's impacting their lives. I think we have been so fortunate that we've, you know, we get a lot of cases, right? And so people, you know, consider us a volume firm or worse, a mill, but we get a lot of cases. And I'm of a mind that, you know, we've done okay in servicing the top end cases. The folks that we've talked to have said, you guys got a lot of room to grow right there. You know, you're doing a good job, you're growing at a good clip, but once you start servicing those high end cases even better, you know, you're going to be in a great place. Structurally, I am actually quite comfortable with the idea that the lawyers in my firm can build their own personal brands. I literally had a conversation about this just a few days ago with the gentleman that I licensed the brand from for the last 8 years. We're actually going away from his brand in a few short weeks. And so, you know, he and I have a very comfortable relationship. It's an amicable parting. I felt like, hey, we're sort of graduating at this point. I'm graduating. I also know that I've got about 2 years of cases worth of inventory, so I'm okay for a little bit in case there's a dip in case acquisition. But as he and I were talking about this, he goes, well, aren't you scared? You know, you're gonna have people leave and this and that. And I said, well, you know, I kind of at this point am thinking of it more so like a college basketball coach or a college football coach that has a coaching tree, where, you know, you have these people that get to a certain point and it's time for them to go. I've seen plenty of law firms that have people leave and go start their own law firms, and both the original law firm and the new one are successful, right? And so I don't have this scarcity mentality that I think a lot of lawyers and law firms, you know, in our industry have. I just don't. You know, Alex Hormozy, who's a big social media guy, wish I had found the guy sooner, even though he's, 20 years my junior. You know, he talked about opening his first gym in Baltimore, and a buddy of his who already had a gym, when he said, hey, yeah, I'm going to open this gym, the guy's like, you know, how could you screw me like that? You know, like, you're going to take all my business or something. And Hormozy was just like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, there's plenty of space for me to open up this gym and for both of us to be successful. And so I'm experimenting with this. If I'm broke in 10 years and it didn't work out, you know, maybe you have me back on the podcast and I could tell you what went wrong, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think I have an opportunity to bring in young lawyers who are really good. I'm 100% owner of the firm, but if I have a lawyer that is able to develop their own personal brand and go out on their own and they're in my market, I'm actually not too worried about that. You know, I've seen other firms and those lawyers survive and everybody seems to be able to eat. So I think that would be a neat legacy to have. And, you know, I'm going to explore that even more in the coming years. But it's, you know, we're going to keep growing. I'm niched, you know, car accidents, the, you know, African-American and Spanish-speaking communities are what I focus on. And I feel as though, you know, big market advertisers to come and sort of flood the zone, they're going to get their cases, but being hyper local and hyper specific and niched is always going to advantage me.
Well, I'll tell you, your attitude is really refreshing. You don't hear that very much, sort of the coaching tree philosophy. I think that's pretty cool. And you're right. I mean, people come and go from firms all the time, and you can maintain relationships. And, you know, people, particularly in the PI world, they're referring, you know, referred, yeah. And you co-counsel, you refer cases. So it's, you know, you can be short-sighted or you can be long-sighted. And I like your attitude. I wish more people would have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said, I think it'll be, you know, it'll be proven out over time. And we have all levels in the firm right now, because, you know, this is just something I started literally, you know, a year and a half ago, sort of encouraging the lawyers in my firm to build their own personal brands. And some have skyrocketed, others are, you know, still trying to get off the ground. But in either instance, you know, we'll accommodate. And if it is time for somebody to graduate, I'm going to say, congratulations. You know, I mean, this is great. You know, we all started as employees somewhere. And if you have a chance to become an owner, I'm happy for you.
Well, that's cool. So I have to keep this podcast going for at least 10 years so I can have you back. You know, I've had a lot of fun today. This has been enlightening for me. I think you've got a lot of cool stuff that you're doing. I can't wait to see, you know, the more cool stuff you're going to do. But for folks out there that may want to get in touch with you and hear more from you, how can they find you?
Yeah, if they want to reach out for a case, it's 1-800-CRASH-VA. If they want to just get me directly, it's Christian@CrashVA.com, and then you can follow me on social at CallChristianVA. So those are the three best ways to get a hold of me.
And if you're a really good player and you want a cool agent, maybe he'll come out of retirement.
That's right. That's right. I'm all for it. I miss going to the game. That was the best part about being an agent. I got to go to, you know, these football and basketball games all over the country. It was great. I couldn't monetize that thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool, Christian. Thanks again. I've had a lot of fun, and good luck, man. You're going to continue doing well.
Thanks, Jonathan. Appreciate you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Founding Partner Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. You can also connect with Jonathan on LinkedIn and check out the show notes with links to resources mentioned throughout our discussion by visiting www.yourlawfirmgc.com. We'll see you next time for more origin stories and insights from successful law firm founders.